The Radio Today programme with Broadcast Bionics. Discover the world's leading brands at bionic.radio.
This is the Radio Today programme. I'm Stuart Clarkson. Coming up later on, we've got James Cridland in Kuala Lumpur, looking ahead to Radio Days Asia, and loads of great audio from the archive with David Lloyd in Radio Moments. But this week it's Roundtable Week with our July 2019 edition, hosted by Trevor Dan.
Original music for this podcast was composed by Macassoy.
Thank you, Stu. We're pleased to be back, and there's no one else here. I mean, there are people around the table. You'll meet them in a minute. But we're in what used to be Jazz FM and also used to be Muddy Knees Media, and they've all gone. So I don't know whether, I mean, frankly, I don't normally do real estate, but you know, if you're looking for a studio, an office space in West One, or even somewhere to live, frankly, this would be ideal. But for now, it's the home of the July Radio Today Roundtable. Let's see who's joined us.
Mike Newman, head of UK content partnerships at Audio Boom.
Audio Boom being
a podcast platform. We host, distribute and monetize podcasts,
including this one.
Yes, including this
one. So it better be good, yeah. Or you'll take it off.
Hi, Trevor. Steve Ackerman, Managing Director of Something Else.
And you are a multi-platform independent production company, so is there anything you don't make?
I'm sure there's plenty of things we don't make, but the things we do make are really audio, TV and social media.
And I'm Graham Mack. I'm the Programme Director of Fix Radio, the new home of the Ugly Phil Breakfast Show. And we also have Ross and Jono at lunchtime.
Last time you came on this podcast, you had to pick something for us to listen to.
That's right.
And you chose an example of Fix Radio, a company who'd already engaged you to be their new programme controller, but you didn't tell us.
No, because I didn't want you to stop me saying that you can't have that as the thing you've been listening to, and I wanted to get it in there.
All right. Well, thanks for coming, everybody. We'll listen to everybody's recommendations in a while. I just thought I might do one thing. We often talk about devices and platforms that people listen on. And I wondered if you could just tell me what devices you use in a typical day to consume your radio and audio. So your live broadcasting or your podcasting. So I'll just do mine to give you the idea. So I start with BBC Sounds on an iPad. Then I go in the bathroom, which has an old FM radio. Then I go downstairs where Alexa will help me get whatever I want. Then I get in the car, ordinary DAB radio. If I'm in the office during the day, I'm weaning myself off the old FM and into the world of just listening off the laptop. And then in the evening, I might have another bit of Alexa. I don't do much listening in the evening. But that's a lot of devices, really, isn't it? And I don't think it's untypical. So, Mike, give me your device schedule.
So in the morning, it will be Google Home that I do for radio. And then in the car, it'll be an FM radio because I'm obviously the second class citizen in the house. So I get the runaround banger. And on the train, it's Apple iPhone through either Apple Podcasts or Spotify. And I'm one of the only people that I know that uses Google Play Music as well if I want to listen
to
it.
Wow.
Yeah.
Is that still going?
It is. I'm popping it up, I think. So I'm a bit of a Google fanboy. So the Google Home, Google Music, and they're all my devices. I think that's it. Yeah.
Steve?
Okay, so I'm DAB in the morning for the Today programme. No car for me. So, because it's training to work, so then it's onto the mobile. Pocket Casts is my app that I use for podcasts, and it's podcast listening. And I found my commute has really changed the past few years. I used to read the newspaper religiously, and that's completely stopped now. And now it's just listening there and back. So
smartphone all day.
Smartphone, well, smartphone on the commutes, yeah. The office is more about the office radio, and that's the there's other people in the office who've got better music taste than me and who are deciding what we listen to. And then the evening, I do a bit of listening in the evening when I'm cooking, really, and that's through the Sonos in the kitchen, and that will tend to be using either Apple Music or again one of the podcast platforms.
So do you do that thing which I have to do of saying, well, in your case, Google or Alexa, play something on Sonos?
Yeah, well no,
it doesn't always work.
No. So I've got the older Sonos where you just type in on my phone what I'm looking for. So I can just type in chill and it'll give me chill playlists or that sort of thing.
This is so fascinating. I wish we did this every week. Yeah. I think I might have invented it.
I'm not sure listeners will be finding it as interesting.
Oh, you can't out-trivia the world of podcasting.
For me, I start on the phone listening to Fix Radio through the app. And then once I know that Phil and everybody have got everything going, I stray onto a few podcasts as I walk to the railway station. I'll do that through Apple Podcasts through the phone. Then I'll go back to Phil on the train, apart from the tunnels. And then when I get into work, I listen through the PC, through a speaker on the PC at work. I don't actually listen to a radio. It's all online listening.
No DAB or FM in the house?
No, there's Alexa in the house, which on the weekends I'll listen. If I want to listen to a football match or something, I'll do that through Alexa. Yeah.
Well, look, I found that very interesting. And Stu, if you didn't, just cut it out and we'll start the show here. The BBC. Well, it's having a week because it's the week of the annual report, but it's also the week of Wimbledon, and we've just had Glastonbury and the Women's World Cup. And I thought it was about time we just considered the BBC, which has had a turbulent time of late. How's it doing? If you had to rate its health, Mike, on a kind of 1 to 10, how healthy is the BBC now? And we are talking on a radio podcast here.
Okay. Yeah, I was going to say, I think it depends on which area of the BBC you're looking at. But I think with what it's doing, particularly for the industry that I'm in now in the podcast space, what it's doing with BBC Sounds, I think, is for the industry as a whole, is in pretty rude health. Because I like the fact that they are slapping the word podcast on the side of buses and on billboards, and it's on after Strictly and at the end of the Women's World Cup and Match of the Day. You know, they're always talking about podcasts. Whether that means that BBC Sounds itself is in rude health, I don't know. You know, I don't know what, because I look at that and I don't think I'm going to listen to that on BBC Sounds. I think I'll find that on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. For what they are doing outwardly and pushing things forward, I would give them an 8 out of 10.
Well, that's not bad. Yeah. Just to stick with Sounds for a second, it's another brand, isn't it?
Yeah,
I briefly saw Glastonbury and had a brand count, you know, and I was counting, well, I'm on BBC One, I'm at BBC Glastonbury, I'm being told about BBC Sounds, I'm being told about BBC Radio One, I'm being told about BBC Online. There's a whole lot of brands out there.
Is that confusing? I think so. It can be very confusing. And I consumed a lot of the Glastonbury coverage over the weekend, which I thought was amazing. And actually this year, I think, was the first time that I really appreciated how much depth it has on the iPlayer. And so, you know, you can pick your set on there and choose whoever you want to see, which I thought was incredible. But yeah, I don't know why I need something in BBC Sounds as well. The BBC Sounds thing does confuse me a little bit as to why that needs to be there when we've got the iPlayer radio and iPlayer TV.
Steve?
I think from a radio perspective, I think the BBC is actually in pretty good shape. When you look over the past year, you look how many new shows and big shows they have had to be reinvented with new hosts, you know, new lineups. I think particularly when you look at what Five Live has done in the podcast space, I think that's really impressive. They seem to really have got to grips with it in the sense of understanding what podcasting is about and the sorts of audiences to try and reach. I agree that BBC Sounds still has some way to go, but I think the BBC acknowledged that as well. You know, James Pennell talks about it being in beta and being early days. I think if I was thinking from a sort of audio and radio perspective, and maybe going back to the point you guys were just chatting about around branding, what one thing I feel the BBC hasn't got quite right is its branding in the podcast space. Because when you go on the podcast charts and you see Radio 4, World Service, 5 Live, BBC Sounds, all as different brands, and you just think, well, come on, to most punters, it's just the BBC, actually. And I mean, I do understand it, that for someone like 5 Live, they're really hoping they can drive you back to the station to listen in some other way. But I'm not convinced that's necessarily how podcasting works, and that's even how the world of branding works these days, though I'm no branding expert. So, but I would say from a sort of radio and audio perspective, I think actually the past year, I think they've done pretty well. And yeah, I'd give them a sort of an 8, maybe an 8.5.
Oh, yeah. Graham.
I'd give them a 7. I think they're doing okay. I think they're just always there, and we take them for granted now that they're always there and they're going to be there. The last time I went on to BBC Sounds was the last time I came on this program, and we were talking about it, so I checked it out, and I haven't been on it since. It's not something that engages me. If I want to listen to something live from the BBC, I'll usually go through TuneIn or something like that just to hear it. So, yeah, I just think they're just there, or they're not doing anything spectacular, but I don't think they're doing that much wrong at the minute.
Glastonbury is an interesting example of how the BBC operates. And I played a small role in the negotiation that got Glastonbury over to the BBC. And I can remember Mark Thompson, who was then controller of BBC Two, saying, I don't think anyone would be very interested in, you know, popular music festival, good Lord. But eventually he was prevailed upon. And in those days, the great argument was, hey, this is something that the BBC could do on radio and television and digital, as we called it in those days. They have now played those cards strongly now, to the extent that if I was an organiser of another British music festival, or indeed any other event, I'd be thinking, why is the BBC spending this colossal amount of money on this one event? And also, should they be spending so much money promoting what is essentially a commercial enterprise?
Why is it then that Glastonbury is the one?
Oh, well, they decided that it was iconic. Somebody wrote a paper, I won't tell you who, saying Glastonbury could become as emblematic of the BBC bringing the nation together as Wimbledon.
But I think in music terms...
You're impressed by that. I think that's how I got it. Anyway.
I think in music terms that's right, though. I think Glastonbury does have that status. I mean, I don't know whether it did at that point in time.
Yeah, because it's going to get the big acts because they're guaranteed primetime TV coverage.
It's not just that. It is the fact. I mean, we were chatting just before we came in here about Glastonbury and the sheer scale of it. I mean, there's no doubt about it. It is the granddaddy of festivals. And we have now reached a time where festival culture and live music is a core bit of the British cultural experience for all age groups. And Glastonbury is the predominant thing. Now, there's definitely the argument about it is a private enterprise and should the BBC be supporting that, but again, you can obviously apply that to sports events as well. So I think it's justified, and I do think it does it really, really well.
One great thing I think the BBC has done is the Women's World Cup. In fact, women's football at all. I don't think there was any coverage of women's football at all until the BBC said, we're going to do some of that. And now here they are, not just with their big TV figures, but it's all over Radio 5 Live as well, and all the better for it.
It is. And I read a stat this morning that the Norway game, the quarterfinal, 7.6 million people watched that. And that's phenomenal. And I think even just 4 years ago, that figure would have been astounding to think that many people would watch it. And I do think that, to Steve's point on Glastonbury, the BBC have helped push that forward. And who else is going to do that? TalkSport aren't going to do that. And that's not to put TalkSport down, but you know, it's not commercially viable for them to throw their lot in and have a go, because I don't think the BBC could have imagined or envisaged it being so big. And I think a lot of that goes down to the fact that they've been brilliant. You know, it's been great to watch. And it's coincided with so many other things that are happening in the world that are pushing women's football forward. But without the BBC there, would it have reach such a wide audience? I don't think so.
And maybe TalkSport would now think of bidding for it.
Yeah.
I think they would. I think the England women's team, I mean, a lot of the girls in that team are going to go on to be superstars now. And the league is going to be a lot even more prominent than it already is. So,
well, hasn't one of the players just got a £1 million deal with Adidas? Yeah, so yeah.
So TalkSport might need a few more women presenters. In fact, a few more women on at all, rather like this podcast. We'll take an advertisement and be back in a tick.
The Radio Today programme with Broadcast Bionics, creators of the Bionic Studio. Listening, watching, reacting to and learning from every spoken word, caller, tweet and SMS to unmix, unlock and understand your content. The Bionic Studio transforms everything about radio except the way you make it.
Today. It's the July roundtable from Radio Today. We've got Graham Mack, we've got Mike Newman, and we've got Steve Ackerman. I'm Trevor Dan, and we're going to go and just talk about podcasting, obviously, because you're from Audio Boom. But I just wanted to start, Steve, you were talking about Wondery, not so much a platform as a production company. What's happened with them?
So Wonder is one of the big podcast production companies based out of LA. If you listen to podcasts, you might know them for shows like Dirty John or Dr. Death that have been big hits and have also transferred to TV. They, about 18 months ago, they raised about $5 million dollars, and you know, so you look at that and think, well, an audio production company raising 5 million, well, that's quite impressive. They've actually just raised 10 million, so another 10 million. And I think what's really interesting in what they've announced is a global aspiration. So they want to take the podcasts that they have and now turn those into other languages and start to create real global titles around them. And I suppose I think that's interesting because it's quite emblematic of everything that's going on in podcasting, which is that there is a global marketplace. And for the first time, audio has an IP value in the same way that TV always has had. And I think the Wondery deal sums that up, really. I mean, they've been valued at, now that 10 million values them at 100 million.
Wow. You as a company, something else, you make a lot of podcasts now. Mm. And I'm wondering whether the job of getting sponsorship has got easier because people now know what they are. You know, so are the brands coming to you and saying, can we have a podcast?
Well, brands are coming wanting podcasts. I think often their expectations are not quite right in terms of how much it costs or how you actually get penetration and people listening. But obviously brands, and this is maybe one that Mike knows more about than me, but brands are definitely wanting to advertise on podcasts. And obviously you can see that. And certainly, we know if you have a hit podcast and you're doing decent numbers, you can earn very good money out of that. And so for us, from a business perspective, the sort of case has been proven, really.
But you wouldn't launch a podcast if you didn't have a sponsor, would you, to pay for it in the first place?
Oh, no, we absolutely would. I mean, our model is get things up and running, bring the audience, and then the advertising and sponsorship money will come. And that's how it's worked for all of our podcasts, all of which are profitable.
So when you say that, are you including podcasts that don't have any spot ads within them? Or pre-roll or...
Well, you've got two different types. So there's podcasts we're making for clients. So we make things like the Penguin podcast, which is a sort of Desert Island Discs for authors. It's paid for by Penguin. There's no advertising in that. Penguin pay for it and we produce it every other week and it's been going on for years and years and years. Then you've got, obviously, our own self-release titles. So things like the David Tennant podcast or the Brights. And those are released without necessarily having advertisers or sponsors in the bag when they start releasing. But as you build up the audience, you bring the sponsors and advertisers in. And obviously that's partly what companies like Audio Boom or Acast do. They find those sponsors and advertisers.
And are you noticing now from your perspective, Mike, that more industries, more people who want to market things are thinking, ka-ching, I'll have a podcast?
They are, but I think there's still more headroom there. There's a heck of a lot more headroom. And I actually think there is a job that the industry has to do, as a podcast industry has to do, to talk to the media agencies and the buying agencies and to persuade them on the power of the podcast. I did a piece at Podcast Days Europe a couple of weeks ago, and I talked about the fact that a huge amount of the revenue that is generated at the moment in podcasts is through direct response. So we all know it, you know, /Harry's or /
Squarespace,
HelloFresh, whatever, and which is great. And I think that there is a sense that is a kind of, oh, that's the junior market, you know, those smaller startups. That's who use podcasts to advertise. We don't need to be in there, says BMW or Mercedes or whatever. But actually, I think the evidence that we see and the success of those direct responses are absolute concrete evidence of the success of advertising in a podcast. Because those startups and those companies who are using it, they will have smaller budgets than those huge, big corporate monsters. So they're going to be much more guarded on how they spend that money. So if they spend £1 million, their budget might only be £1 million. You know, so if they're going to put all of their budget into podcasting, they're going to be very, very cautious and precious about how they spend it and what they get back from it. And so the direct response really works. So for every pound I put down, I know exactly how much I'm getting back. And what we've seen is that revenues have increased year on year, exponentially increasing. So that has to be working, because you can't be a direct response advertiser and then come back and spend double the amount this year if last year's money didn't work. And it's not working because they are direct response. That's just a byproduct of them advertising. It's working because the podcast audience is incredibly engaged. So I think that that's one thing that I think as an industry we perhaps need to do more work on, is to talk to agencies from that perspective of, this is just a very, very engaged audience, and you don't necessarily need a direct response message.
Is there anybody talking to agencies on behalf of the podcast business, or are you Audio Boom and Acast and all the others going in separately and doing your own individual deals?
Separately, yeah. I don't think there's anybody doing it as a collective.
No, but obviously in the UK, there's only a small number of media agencies you've got to go and speak to. Yeah. I mean, our experience is the direct response thing is definitely true out of the States. So with audiences you're monetizing in the States, and we've been lucky enough to do that, most of the brands you see a direct response. Actually, in the UK, we've seen quite a lot of blue chip brands coming to the table, and it seems to be increasing quite rapidly now.
I mean, don't get me wrong, they are there. Yeah. You know, our Formula One podcast, Audio Boom, is sponsored by Bose, and that's not a direct response. But I think there is a whole market there that there is a lot of people that they're not yet tapping into.
As a radio station program controller then, Graham, with a brand like Fix, how important is the online space at all? Do you want to have podcasts? Do you have podcasts, or is really live radio what you're on about?
Currently, we don't have any podcasts, but we're talking at the moment, because we've got content that is only going on the air once, like Ugly Phil and Russ and Jono, that we've got the potential to do it. The worry at the moment is, particularly with Russ and Jono, we're getting a spike in our streaming figures every day when they're on between 12 and 1, and we run a best of on a Saturday morning. What would happen if Russ and Jono fans from around the country who are coming to us just for that could get them on a podcast whenever they want? It's something we're going to have to experiment with, but at the moment, we're not doing it.
But I guess what I'm trying to get a sense of is, are your advertisers saying to you, oh yes, I don't mind this, that and the other, but can I have a bit of podcast? Have you got any of those?
We haven't had advertisers say that, but we have had people who are not advertisers ask the question, because we target a specialist audience of tradespeople. You know, they want to get to that audience to sell tools and various other things. They have asked if that is available, and we've said, yeah, if you can tell us exactly what it is you want, we'll make it for you. We haven't done it yet. We're only 2 years in. We're only 2 years old.
And was it you, Steve, who said that sometimes clients misunderstand how much it costs? Mm. Is there a sense, a bit like there is with photography, you don't need a photographer, we've all got a camera. Is there a sense that podcasting is by nature a cheap thing?
I think there is to some degree still. I think when you listen to lots of the podcasts that became hits a few years back, as we know, a lot of them were three people around a kitchen table having a chat, and podcasting's evolving very fast now, and production standards are very high, and obviously there's some really fantastic productions coming up. But I still think there is a sense from clients of, oh, well you can just put some mics in my boardroom, can't you? Am I chief exec will host it, and you know, all that sort of thing. And look, I think there is a space for that, and there's actually a really thriving freelance audio professional market. I think probably in a way there wasn't many years ago, because obviously there wasn't really the work. So there's lots of individual freelancers who are doing those sorts of podcasts and helping clients facilitate that sort of thing. But I think for the more blue chip clients, they're quickly realizing that, you know, if you want something decent, you've got to pay for how it's going to sound from an audio perspective. But you also, obviously, for any podcast, got to think about the marketing that's going to sit around that. Because as we know, there are thousands of podcasts out there. Discoverability is still really an issue. It's not really great in terms of whatever podcast platform you use. And therefore, you've got to build some sense of marketing or social media activity around that podcast to ensure the audience are going to find it in some way.
We must get onto your recommendations. But just one other thing. The whole business of finding stuff, like you just said, I find when you guys give me your clips, I just Google them and there they are. And I don't bother, in fact, I don't even know what platform it is. It's a bit like using Alexa to get a piece of music or something. Does that bother you, Mike? Is Audio Boom a brand that you want to have on everybody's lips?
Not at all. No, quite the opposite. So our view is that if you are sitting on our platform as a podcaster, we'd very, very much rather you didn't talk about us. Talk about Apple Podcasts, talk about Spotify, talk about Castbox, Pocket Cast, because that's where your listeners are going. We're not a listening destination. So I think, you know, we house and you can listen to podcasts on our website, because I think it'd be slightly odd to be a podcast company and not have a website where you can hear a podcast. But no, that is not where we want to drive people. And in fact, we switched off our app. We did have an app till about 6-12 months ago. The tech guy said they sunsetted it, so switched it off. And because, you know, you're it's like starting a social media channel and going, oh, come to us, don't go to Facebook. You know, you've got to go where,
like,
the
BBC
are.
Sounds, for instance.
But also, Trevor, actually, funnily enough, you mentioning that, surreptitiously, you've mentioned, I think, one of the big audio moments that's completely gone under the radar, because it was about a month ago that Google first launched this. So, as you say, if you type in a podcast title, if it searches high enough anyway, on your front page will come up the podcast, and you can click straight through to hear it, can't you? I think that's what you're saying. That didn't exist before, and that's because Google have said they want to put audio best in class in terms of search. So what that means is, in exactly the same way as when you type in for you might type something else and a video clip comes up and you can click straight through, this is now the first time you can do this with audio. You couldn't do this many months ago, and that's a real revolution. And the reason Google are doing that is because they quite rightly identified that the majority of podcast listening still happens through Apple devices, but obviously the majority of handset ownership is Android devices, and so they absolutely want to encourage audio usage amongst Android owners. And so for anyone who creates podcasts or radio shows, this is a really fantastic moment, because suddenly audio is about to become a lot more discoverable in a way that it's never really been before.
Steve Ackerman is here from something else. We've got Graham Mack from Fix Radio, and we've got Mike Newman from a company that we apparently don't have to mention.
And Audio Boom.
We'll hear all their recommendations after this.
Yes, that's coming up in just moments. First, a quick word about CleanFeed. It's great for doing OBs or co-hosting from remote places, doing interviews for your podcast or your radio show. And it's really simple to use and connect in live quality audio over the web using just a browser. CleanFeed has been designed for radio people and for podcasters, and it's really simple to use. As I say, it won't cost you anything to get started. It'll just take you 30 seconds to sign up, and within minutes you'll be doing your first live interview or recording for your show or podcast. Find out more about it at cleanfeed.net. That's cleanfeed.net. Trevor.
Right, we must bash on with your recommendations. Graham, you haven't spoken for a while, so I'm going to start with you.
I've been listening to a reasonably new podcast. I think it's only been about 6 or 7 episodes. It's Andrew Denton, and the podcast is called Interview. And
who he?
Andrew Denton is an Australian TV personality. When I lived in Australia, I saw him, and he's a good interviewer, and he's just done a nice one with Michael Caine. He's just done one with Cher that I'm about halfway through, and a great one with Steve Martin and Martin Short. Sometimes they have an audience, sometimes they're just in a hotel room, but they're just great interviews.
Yeah. Here's a clip.
My mother used to put olive oil in her ears to get the earwax out. And then people were putting it on food. I thought, what are they, nuts? I can't eat that stuff. But you grow out of it, of course.
Can I go back to the garlic smell for a second? I'd just like you to talk about that patrol you went on in No Man's Land.
Well, that was very important. When you were a young man, I was 19. We have national service in England, and I was sent to Korea. And obviously you're terrified you're going to get killed. And also you've got to kill people. So it's very, very difficult. The first thing you think about when you're going into that situation, am I a coward? Mm. You know, you don't know you're a coward. You've never been in a situation where cowardice would come about. And it was a wonderful thing for me, because what happened when we met the patrol, the Chinese patrol, is we went the other way back towards their line and right round them. But while we were doing that, we were all prepared to die, but we were going to make it very, very expensive as possible. And so that was a great lesson for me, is that I wasn't a hero. I didn't win the Victoria Cross or anything, but at least I knew I wasn't a coward when I came home. You know?
Yeah, and as you know, nobody knows until they reach that moment.
Yeah, and you've got to reach that situation.
I want to go back on the reason I mentioned the smell of sardines is to do with when you were evacuated as a child. The first family you were billeted with, they would lock you under the stairs.
Oh, blimey, yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, well, me and a boy called Clarence. we were six and a half, seven, and they went away for the weekends a lot somewhere we didn't know. But they would lock the two of us up in a cupboard under the stairs with bottles of water and sardines and bread. And they used to let us out Monday morning. They put us in there Friday night and let us out Monday morning.
That must have been terrifying for a young boy.
Oh, yeah, yeah. It means now that I had suffered from incredible claustrophobia. And it also means that I'm one of the patrons of the National Society of Prevention of Cruelty to Children.
What's good about him?
I think, like all great interviewers, the show's about the guest. And like all great interviewers, they're a little bit shy and nerdy. You know, if you think of like Marc Maron and maybe even Michael Parkinson, they're not stars. They're not loud, brash stars. And he's just like a quiet guy who asks interesting questions of the guests.
Steve, you're first.
My first one is pulling up a very old title, or a relatively old title, but I think doing something really interesting, which is The Daily from the New York Times. And about 3 or 4 weeks ago, they actually gave over the show for an entire week to look at Europe and to ask the question, which feels like a big question, is liberal democracy dead? And I thought what was interesting is you're taking a really hefty question and yet turning that really managing to take an approach that's a very populist, easily accessible approach. And so each day the programme was looking at a different country around Europe, and they really were delving into this issue. And so each episode was really related to the others. They kept referring back, and it was done in an absolutely brilliant way that's really, really listenable in what is a really sort of hefty issue, but it's been done in a really accessible manner.
Here's a clip where their European correspondent is talking about Brexit.
So for me, the story starts when I start to doubt Europe. And there were two moments that really crystallised this for me.
The total number of votes cast in favour of leave...
The first was Brexit.
...was 17,410,742. This means that the UK has voted to leave the European Union.
The British people have spoken, and the answer is, we're out.
I was living in London at the time with my family. I was a correspondent there. And, you know, the European Union has always been a certainty in my life. It's sort of this thing that has always been there and I thought would always be there. You know, I'm German. My husband is Welsh. We met at university in London. And it's kind of incredible, but our grandfathers fought on two different sides of World War II. And now we have three children. And they're little Europeans who basically speak both of our languages and feel at home in both of our countries. So when I woke up to the news on that morning in June 2016... that Britain was leaving the European Union, it was kind of the first time that Europe felt fragile. It was kind of this moment that put a doubt in my mind about the European Union, and that felt very new. And then in 2018, I actually moved back to my own country, to Germany, for the first time in like over 20 years. And Germany at the time felt very different from the UK. It was kind of considered to be this bastion of liberal democracy. But there was a backlash building here too. And one of the first things I started reporting on when I got back was this rise of the far right.
There's almost a hint of Brexit cast about that. There's a proper correspondent, but telling you a personal story. And it's something that the New York Daily is very good at.
Yeah, and they, for each episode, they're meeting real people on the ground. And I thought, actually, what they're doing is what Five Live quite likes to try and do. But I thought they were, without being too rude to Five Live, I thought they were doing it better.
Can I give a shout out to Emma Barnett, though, who is on fire?
Yeah, yeah.
She is just, you know, possibly a step behind James O'Brien, but she is just the most unmissable interviewer on, you know, about politics on the radio.
Well, I think Emma from as soon as she was on the radio and before, obviously she's a journalist, a trained journalist, and she's always had a really fantastic sort of sense of what people are talking about and how to get to the heart of the story quickly. I think she's a phenomenal broadcaster.
Mike Newman, you're first.
Revisionist history.
Ah, now this is Malcolm Gladwell, whose books I adore.
Yes, and I think if you adore his books, as do I, and you haven't yet heard this podcast, I can't imagine there's anybody listening to the show that doesn't know the podcast, so I feel a bit bad bringing it in. But it's just come out on season 4, and I mean, He's so compelling. To the opposite of Graham's point on Andrew Denton, who it's kind of not about him. It's kind of all about Malcolm Gladwell, you know, and he's just incredible. And he can make the most the compelling subjects. He breaks them down and makes you understand them in a different way. So there was a kind of mini series in season two about the civil rights movement, which was so engaging. And then he can take the most mundane and seemingly boring subjects like golf, and he did 40 minutes on it that I was hooked on, about why golf is the worst sport in the world, and he's absolutely right. But it's just,
other views are available.
It's just so compelling and really engaging.
Let's hear this clip where he and his assistant are trying to pass the law exam in New York.
I got the idea of taking the LSAT from a man named William Henderson. I read a paper that he wrote. It was on my favorite website, SSRN, which is where academics from around the world post their papers and they get ranked. If you're a regular listener to this podcast, you'll know how genius I think SSRN is. Anyway, this paper was called The LSAT, Law School Exams and Meritocracy, The Surprising and Under-Theorized Role of Test-Taking Speed. Anything with the words surprising and under-theorized in the title, of course, is going to be catnip for me. So I read it. Then I read it again. Then I had to meet him.
So just a little bit of background here. I didn't go to law school until I was 35. And so I had a whole career before then.
What were you doing before you became a lawyer?
I was a firefighter paramedic. I was a union rep for a suburban Cleveland fire department. I did that for 9 years. And as I kid people, and remember I'm kidding, as I went to law school because of those bastard management attorneys.
Henderson goes to law school. After that, he gets a clerkship with a judge. And one day, he's in the shower and a thought occurs to him.
Wait, what was the aha in the shower? The specific aha was what?
My God, the two most time-pressured things I've ever done in my life is taking the LSAT and these damn law school exams.
He had been a firefighter paramedic. He had raced to the streets of Cleveland to save people on the brink of death. And the most time pressure he'd ever felt was taking the LSAT to get into law school and then taking the exams once he got there.
Proctor said time, and everybody dropped their pencils, and there was this huge ugh. You know, everybody was like groaning that they didn't get more time to keep on working on Cass Sunstein's element exam. It's like, you know, 90 people who all dropped their pencil and they're all, you know, exclaiming the desire for more time. That was a memorable experience.
Now, I'm sure this is obvious to you, particularly if you're an American. You've been tested 1,000 times in your life. SAT, ACT, GRE, on and on. And every one of those standardized tests doesn't just test whether you can answer the question correctly. They test how quickly you can answer the question correctly. But I'm a Canadian. I've never taken a standardized test in my life. And as an outsider, I have to say, the whole system seems really weird. Why is quicker better?
There's Malcolm Gladwell and revisionist history. We'll go straight on to your second choice, Mike.
My second choice, I'm trying to mold radio and podcast together here. So it's a podcast that's sitting on the Audio Boom Network, and it's called I Secretly Recorded My Boyfriend. It's from...
Do I need to put a klaxon alert in?
No, you're okay. You're okay. Well, yes, if you do go and listen to it, it's very potty-mouthed, but there is a warning at the start of it. So the podcast is actually created by a radio team. So they are the current breakfast show at Gem in the East Midlands. Joe Russell, formerly of Joe and Twiggy at Trent. And I think they take their skill as broadcasters and bring it into the podcast space, but do it and make it feel like a podcast. They are not just doing a reversioned radio show. It's a very different show. It's very funny. Very engaging. And so there's three of them. It's Joe and Sparky and their newsreader, Katie. And Joe has secretly recorded her boyfriend, who is a Brummie mechanic. And he's just hilarious. I would liken it to, I think it's like a working class version of Dad Wrote a Porno.
He's not the brightest button in the box, is he, as we will hear?
What do you think about the big news?
Theresa May.
No, I haven't heard it. I haven't had the word.
She's announced she's going a week on Friday.
Oh, has she?
Yeah, she's leaving.
For the end of May? No. The end of May?
Oh,
That's a good time for her to go, isn't it, though, at the end of May? So, is that how so I can remember?
7th of June.
Matt, what?
That's what it'll be.
Why don't you just go the end of May?
7th
is it
of
really
June.
Worth doing one more week?
7th of June.
See, that hard up for another week's wages. I just had book
you
it.
Think it's because she's got
Can't
meetings.
She book it as holiday? That's last week. She can book that as an holiday, surely.
She's got meetings.
So May would finish. See, if you had that in a sweepstake, when's May going to retire? The end of May?
No, 7th of June.
Well, near enough the end of May.
Has a man ever worked harder to make a gag work?
Although I do remember seeing headlines to that effect, so yeah. he's on a par with them.
He's on a par with the Daily Star.
Yes.
He moved on, of course. He had an opinion on who should be the next Prime Minister.
You know, we need... There's a couple of Prime Ministers. Sir Alan... what's his name? Alan Sugar.
He's not a Prime Minister.
No, but he'd make a bloody good one. And who's that bloke who does ITV in the morning?
Piers Morgan.
Oh, my God.
Piers Morgan. Right,
Piers Morgan. Sir Alan Sugar. I want one of them. I would vote for them.
Okay.
They don't beat around the bush.
A brew.
They're literally straight to the point, no bullshit, bang.
That's how I secretly recorded my boyfriend. Who makes that?
What they do it themselves.
They do it themselves.
But they're under the banner of Secret Recordings. So they've set themselves out as a whole company. So they've got a few other podcasts under their banner as well. The Secret World of Slimming Clubs is very good as well. Well worth. More power to them. They're doing a great job.
Back to Steve.
So my second one might seem like it's a shameless plug, but it's not, because I think it's quite interesting. Our newest podcast release is called Frank Turner's Tales from No Man's Land. And Frank Turner, for those who don't know, is a very successful sort of punk folk rock star, very big in the States as well as here. He has a new album coming out in August. And so this podcast is a co-production with Polydor. And I should say that each song on the album is about a woman in history. It tells the story of a woman in history. So the podcast, each episode, he looks at that woman in history and goes and meets experts who can tell him a little bit more about that person, and he can dig into the story. So, for instance, the first episode is about a lady called Sister Rosetta, and she was the African-American woman who actually started rock and roll but wasn't given the credit for it because she was a black woman. Exactly. Mike's looking at me like, wow. Because, no one's literally heard of her, but there's an area of a museum in Memphis dedicated to her now, and people are starting to realise what her role was. So the first episode looks at her story. And what's interesting about the podcast and the way it's being marketed is that as each episode drops, the relevant song from the album will be released right through for 6 or 7 weeks until the album is released in August.
Here's Frank Turner.
Hi there, Frank Turner here. Three things to know about me. I'm a songwriter, I'm a massive history nerd, and yes, I'm a man. That last part is relevant because I've written a new album all about women called No Man's Land. 12 songs about real historical women, and one song about my mum. Their stories are fascinating, moving, funny, and most importantly, worth sharing and celebrating. So I've decided to make a podcast called Tales from No Man's Land to help us get to know these people a little bit better. There'll be an episode for each song with guest musicians, historians, and if she says yes, my mum. You can subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. The first episode will be out in July, so tune in. And be sure to stay tuned for details of my new album.
By the way, if you've got that YouTube, just do a little search for Sister Rosetta. Granada Television made a film about the blues stars of the age in about 1967, and they filmed it at a railway station in Manchester, and she's on it, and she is just blistering. She out Chuck Berry is Chuck Berry.
Wow, I'll be looking her up as soon as I get
amazing. Finally, we're back to Graham. Now, this, Graham, feels like a pretty typical choice, but why have you chosen it?
Well, it's Test Match Special. I've chosen it because I've only just discovered cricket on the radio.
No!
I never used to... Well, I'm not even a big cricket fan.
You don't have to be, though, do you?
No. It's just that I have three passports. I'm a citizen of three countries, and one of those countries is New Zealand. And because my passports are British...
Is this a scene from some audiobook about... It's an Eric Ambler book.
I've got a British passport, an Australian passport, and a New Zealand passport. And of those three, New Zealand would be the underdog of the three in the world in the Cricket World Cup. So I'm like rooting for New Zealand. And I don't have Sky, but I've got the Now TV, which means I have to pay money if I want to watch it, But I'm not that big a fan. So I thought, well, I'll put it on the radio. And I put on Test Match Special. It's wonderful to listen to New Zealand getting beaten by Pakistan. But it's just a great, just a really, really good listen. And I'm looking forward to tomorrow to listening to England, New Zealand.
Absolutely, big game.
Yes. So
here's a clip of TMS.
It may be that Peterson's doing something to his bat. He's got his back to us. And whether something's happened to that... I'll tell you what he's doing, Geoffrey. He's putting a new rubber on his bat.
A new rubber in the middle of the game.
He is. Whether he's taken one off first or he's putting a new one on, but he's doing it quite professionally. It's never terribly easy doing that. You've got to make sure you've got no floppy stuff on the end. You've got to get it all on. Roll it down that big stick. That's what's going on. I think Peterson must have said to the umpire, I've got a problem here, I need a new bat rubber. And he's put it on himself. Although he's told, actually, the youngster who brought it out, by the look of it, to just finish it off. And so they've called drinks. Oh, very odd. Michael, Vaughan's beside me. It's not easy putting a rubber on, is it?
No, it's not. I was never good at that.
2-10 for two. In comes Fernando. Bowls, and that's turned away to backward square leg. And they'll come back for two. You know what I meant.
Should we move on?
You know what I meant.
Hello, Henry.
One of the great things about TMS is something that the podcast world has subsequently discovered, which is just shooting the breeze can be a very attractive thing. You think, for those of us who worked in radio over the years, the number of times we've been told or we've told other people, just shut the fuck up, eh? No one's interested in you. Keep banging out the tunes or whatever it is. And here's TMS. They don't care, do they?
No, where they go.
Waffle away just about who's inviting who round to the barbecue tonight.
It's wonderful.
Utterly charming.
Yeah.
And in a way, quite British.
Yeah, definitely.
They don't even care if it's dull. good. Well, this show hasn't been dull. I don't think it has, anyway. Any other business at all, Graham?
No, only that you can...
Something listen to plug?
At Fix Radio.
Oh,
you can listen to us online on the app or on DAB in London and Manchester. Ugly Phil in the morning, brand new show, we're 4 weeks old. Russ and Jono at lunchtime. If you're a tradesman,
are you telling him to shut up?
No, I'm not actually.
It's got to say good luck with
that. No, yeah. No, it's been great. I mean, we are a station for tradesmen, but I think lots of people will like it because it is just working class humour.
We are all tradesmen in our way. Steve.
Am I allowed to plug something here?
Of course,
right.
Yeah.
This is
positively encouraged.
Oh, okay. So another new release coming in a couple of weeks' time is with the comedy actress Katie Brand and Catherine Parkinson, who you may know from the IT Crowd. And they get together, and it's a podcast called Women Like Us, where they're two in-between column journalists looking at women's issues. They think they've created the first women-only podcast. So, yeah.
Mike.
It will be an Audio Boom original podcast called Covert, back for season two today. First episode dropped, looking at Argo, that you might remember from the Ben Affleck movie. And it looks at different kind of CIA missions and black ops that have gone right or gone wrong. It's brilliant, fascinating stuff.
Thank you, Mike Newman from Audio Boom and Steve Ackerman from Something Else and Graham Mack from Fix Radio. I've been Trevor Down. This has been the July Roundtable, which has been produced and researched by Eve Williams. Well done, Eve. And next month we won't be here. And in September we probably won't be here, but we'll be here. But who knows where he will be. Back to you, Stu.
Fascinating as always. Thank you, Trevor. And David Lloyd, still to come on this podcast. That's after we take you to the other side of the world.
In Kuala Lumpur, in Malaysia, I'm James Cridland, the radio futurologist. And why am I in Malaysia? Well, I'm planning for Radio Days Asia, a new radio conference for Asia to be held here at the end of August. Radio Days Asia might sound familiar if you've been to Radio Days Europe as well, it might, but radio across Asia has lots of different challenges and opportunities and has hitherto been served by formal conferences as part of a bigger event. Radio Days Asia, though, is a place where radio can stand on its own two feet and shine, and I am certainly looking forward to it. It was interesting to visit BFM, which is the business radio station here. The last time I visited, it was a busy place, and I was interviewed in a typical radio studio about the future of radio. This time, though, I discovered it had moved. Now in a gleaming new office block. The new digs retained the vibrancy and atmosphere of the old studios, but much time had been spent making the station feel modern, bright, airy, with many more studios. Natural wood and lighting is all around, and the station hummed with activity as producers and presenters worked on their output. After a meeting about Radio Days Asia, I was interviewed, along with Radio Days Asia's Rosie Smith, for a radio show on the station, but this time I wasn't in one of their beautiful new studios overlooking the city. Rosie and I were perched on stools in front of a green screen. Our microphones were decent quality Rode lapel mics, and we were being filmed with two cameras in 4K. The station has very much grasped the opportunities that multi-platform radio has to offer. It's a deserved leader in the world of podcasting in KL, but also produces much video content and understands that the best way to reach audiences is to go to them wherever they are rather than to attempt to control where their content is. Asia is a world of contrasts, and I'm very much looking forward to Radio Days Asia. You should consider coming too. Malaysia is a land of smiles and happiness, and is also quite wonderfully cheap. There's lots to learn from speakers from North America and Europe, sure, but also many speakers from across Asia. And naturally, a fair amount of podcast activity too. You'll find more information at www.radiodaysasia.com. And most importantly, I found an excellent craft beer place, just 2 minutes' walk from the hotel. What more could you want? You can get my weekly newsletter at james.crid.land and daily podcast news at podnews.net. And until next time, keep listening. And now on the Radio Today programme, here's David Lloyd.
Radio 1 was on air for over 20 years before the rollout of its FM transmitters was complete, and then it was a case of closing down the old AM frequencies, ready to hand them over to the commercial sector.
Adjust your sets right now. That's all Radio 1 programmes on AM 1053 and 1089. We'll now revert permanently to FM between 97 and 99. Please adjust your sets to hear Radio 1. Radio 1 only on FM 97 to 99, 1053 and 1089, closing down in 5 minutes. So retune now if you're still on medium wave, and you'll hear Stephen Tintin Duffy. You'll hear Stephen...
This is 1053 and 1089 medium wave, the frequencies formerly occupied by BBC Radio 1. Radio 1 is now an FM-only station. Please retune your radio to FM... It may also be marked VHF or U, where you'll find us between 97 and 99.
Maybe that's how we'll close down FM too one day. Maybe not with Stephen Tintin Duffy, though. Mark Goodyear's plaintive cry, and before that, Steve Wright this week in 1994. And it was 20 years ago this week that Steve began afternoons on Radio 2 as The Big Show returned to the BBC, replacing Ed Stewart.
Hello, darling.
Thank you.
Summer 1999. Steve Wright in the afternoon.
Hello. This is Steve here on Radio 2. How you doing there? All right. So nice to be back with you. I just can't tell you. Partly cloudy, partly sunny, scattered thunder showers. The pollen count is low. In Florida, 33 and storms. This is Steve Wright in the afternoon. Monday, 5th of July, 1999.
The start of 20 years of Steve Wright in the afternoon on Radio 2. His Radio 1 spell, by the way, was only 12 years. In the early 60s, as the UK wondered whether it would ever get anything other than the BBC, a new licensed broadcaster was springing up elsewhere in the British Isles 55 years ago this week.
This is Manx Radio, broadcasting on 188 metres on the medium wave band and also on 89 and 91.2 megacycles VHF from Douglas, Isle of Man. And we'll be broadcasting on 188 meters on the medium wave band until 9 o'clock.
Manx Radio launched in stereo on VHF, later getting its AM. John Grierson was the first general manager.
Mostly it was me just talking about this, that and the other, doing some very, very, very local parochial news and playing music, which of course was very difficult to come by because in those days you had the almighty power of the musicians' union, the BBC, ranged against us.
Manx Radio is the Isle of Man's national commercial radio station, broadcasting from Douglas Head in the beautiful Isle of Man. To those of you who guard and protect us during the night, to the police and firemen, to those in the lighthouse service and coast guards, to doctors and nurses attending the sick, indeed to all who have to work while others sleep, we wish you a quiet and peaceful night.
Beautiful, isn't it? Manx Radio, which launched this week in 1964, broadcasting originally from a caravan. If you're of a certain age, Sunday tea times would have meant getting your plimsoll bag ready for school and hearing this on your mum's radio.
We invite you to Sing Something Simple, a selection of songs, old and new, sung by the Cliff Adams Singers, accompanied by Jack Emblow.
You've been listening to Sing Something Simple, a collection of favourite songs sung by the Adams Singers, directed by Cliff Adams and accompanied by Jack Emblow. So it's goodbye. Until
Sing Something Simple, which began 60 years ago this week, then on the BBC Light programme, originally actually on Friday nights, replacing Vera Lynn's programme, actually. I bet she was pretty peeved about that. Probably stormed out of the presenters' meeting, saying, I've been replaced by some organ music. And probably a memo went round later, as always, thanking Vera for all her good work on Sundays. Right, now, 1976, and a quick Radio 1 farewell.
2:10, before we move on any further, I'd like to take the opportunity of wishing the very best of luck to Johnny Walker. No doubt you heard Johnny's programme immediately before we came on the air, and you'll know that it's the last one, and Johnny is going to seek his fame and fortune and another life in California. Actually, I have never been to the States, funnily enough, although I'm hoping to go in September.
David Hamilton marking Johnny Walker's farewell from Radio 1. He returned about 10 years later. That was 1976, and this time that year we were in the middle of a beautiful heat wave. Heathrow had 16 consecutive days over 30 Celsius, and the previous summer was pretty hot too. A good time to start commercial radio in Nottingham. Radio
Trent. I'll go along with that. Radio Trent it is. 6:10. Good morning, sleepyhead. What about attitude dancing?
Our daytime music policy is targeted at quite a wide range of people, but in the evenings you have to recognise that most of the people that listen to Radio Trent during the day are watching television. The only really important group of people who listen to the radio in the evenings are young people. We target a programme of contemporary music, which is heavier rock music, which is targeted almost exclusively at students and at people who have a serious appreciation of contemporary music, rather than a background appreciation of pop, which is, quite frankly, what we provide to most people during the day. Most people who really know what they're doing in daytime radio would admit that we are background. We accept that. We are wallpaper. I don't see anything wrong in that at all. People take a lot of care in choosing their wallpaper.
Speaking just before launch in the new studio complex as it was built in Nottingham in 1975, Radio Trent's first programme controller, Bob Snyder. So with BBC Radio York starting 36 years ago...
Selby or Filey, Nesborough or Morton, Scarborough or Harrogate or Pickering or Norton, we're North Yorkshire. And we're with you in North Yorkshire. From the heart, BBC Radio York. In North Yorkshire.
Radio Lancashire, emerging from Radio Blackburn 38 years ago.
Radio Blackburn, the Lancashire sound on the air.
The BBC Trust rejecting plans to close Six Music 9 years ago.
The notion that the geniuses at the BBC would concoct that kind of solid gold PR plan is just daydreaming.
Apple launching Beats One 4 years ago.
Amazing show, Ebro, man. You just smashed it in New York.
Woman's Hour moving from Radio 2 to Radio 4 46 years ago.
Well, I'd like to ask all the husbands round the table whether they think it's a good idea to have more than one wife.
And Richard Bacon falling very ill this time last year.
He said, I've looked at your X-ray and it's horrible. I need to put you into an induced coma so that we can control your breathing. And if I don't do that, you're probably going to die.
Those are this week's Radio Moments.
The Radio Today programme with Broadcast Bionics.
Original music for this podcast was composed by Mikasa.